Today is August 28th, 2015. My name is Christine Navarro-McLean. You're interviewing for Arizona State University for the Dinner 2040 Project. Good morning, could I ask you to tell me your name and your title, please?
I am Ashley Shimke. I work with the Arizona Department of Education in their Health and Nutrition Services Division, and I work on farm-to-school and school garden development.
So let's talk a little bit about your background. Can you tell me a little bit about where you were raised?
I'm an Arizona native, born and raised here in the Phoenix area, actually. Never really lived anywhere else. I've lived in Tempe, I now live in Gilbert, and I've lived in Phoenix, so I know the valley well. I was born in Good Sam Hospital downtown.
So let's talk about kind of where you grew up and kind of your family and the values that they shared with you, especially about health and cooking and...
So I am one of five children. I have an older brother, and then I have, fun fact, three other siblings that are the same age as me. I'm a quadruplet. So I'm one of four. Mom and dad definitely didn't plan to have four in one shot, but they did. And so because of that, dad's an engineer, when he was first starting his career, you know, you don't always make a lot of money up front. And my mom's a teacher. And she, when we were growing up, stayed home. She was a stay-at-home mom, take care of all five of us. So Costco was our grocery store, our food for less. That's where we shopped. We bought a lot of canned food, or a lot of frozen food, a lot of... I remember one of the things that I hate now, but I totally understand and respect why mom bought it then, is like those flaked potatoes, those dehydrated potatoes. I think we all five of us kids now completely appreciate real potatoes that you can, you know, mash up. And so mashed potatoes are just kind of one of those special things in our life now that we probably appreciate more now because we grew up on those flaked potatoes. I think I've always enjoyed food. From a very young age, my mom always cooked. We cooked all the time. We rarely went out to eat. We just didn't have the money for that. So we always ate at home. And so I think I just saw mom cooking in the kitchen and found that to be interesting. I had an easy bake oven as a kid, and as anyone who's worked with an easy bake oven, it's annoying. It takes forever to make one thing, but as a kid, you don't care. You're just like, in 30 minutes, I'm going to have a very tiny brownie. It's fine. I thought I was going to start like a business with among my siblings, and I was going to make... We played a lot of make-believe games, I guess. That's what you do when you're a kid. And we had baby dolls and stuff, and I was going to be the baker for the baby doll birthdays. And use fake money, I suppose, to barter with that. But so that's funny. But somewhere along the lines, mom was like, why don't you just bake for real in the kitchen with real cooking equipment? And I jumped at the chance to do that. And so probably throughout high school, mom and dad were very... nice and bought a lot of whatever I needed to make, whatever I felt like making. I guess it was twofold, like, sweet, we don't have to make something and you can make it for us. And, you obviously enjoy this, so we're going to go ahead and let you do that. So Costco flour bags were, you know, something in the freezer, and, you know, if it didn't work out, it's not the end of the world. I always remember that being, I feel very fortunate looking back at that, mom and dad really supporting that. I at one point thought I was going to go to culinary school, and then I didn't know if I had the thick skin and the drive to like kind of excel and be at that place where you get to create. A lot of people who go through culinary school, I feel like, are kind of stuck because going out to eat is such a big deal these days. There's so many restaurants, and so the competition to be a chef is super strict and cutthroat, and I just didn't want to be that mean cutthroat person to have to get through the layers of competitiveness to make it into that place where you get to be the executive chef and create really innovative dishes. And so I was like, maybe that's not for me. which I think pleased my dad. Dad was not really thrilled with the idea of me not going to college, given dad had a master's and mom was working on her master's, but, mom was supportive. She's like, whatever's going to make you happy. So I ended up coming to ASU and decided I was going to open up a jazz club because I also have a background in music. I play trombone. And I also didn't think I had the skill, per se, to make it big and be the musician that would actually bring in money. And I didn't really want to be a music teacher, so I decided I would go to business school and I would learn to hire the best chefs and hire the best musicians, and I would create this place that celebrated jazz music in a way that I didn't think existed in the world today. Looking back now with all the quote-unquote hipsters that are about and all of the old-fashioned drinks that are kind of trendy right now, I probably would have been successful, at least for a little while, had I stuck with that. But somewhere along the way, in my business degree, we had to take a certain amount of science classes to round out our programming. So I chose to take things like botany and anatomy, and somewhere along the way, I took a class called, I can't even remember the title perfectly, but it had something to do with healthcare innovations or something like that. And I was like, well, that sounds cool. I mean, most of the class was about insurance, which I tell you is not my cup of tea. But there was something that struck me when I was still on business track at that point, that stuck out to me. And they had talked about nutrition being a field that people study, and that it is a preventative measure to reduce healthcare costs. And I didn't know much about healthcare costs or even really realize the epidemic that we were living in with obesity and all of that. And so that's kind of where I was like, I don't think I like business. I didn't really like the people that I was going to school with. A lot of the kids I went to school with just wanted to make a lot of money, and they didn't really have like a personal or passionate drive to change the world in any particular way. And I was like, that can't be all you want in this life. There's got to be more than money. There's no way that money could make me happy. And I guess I knew that from a young age. But so I decided to switch my major to nutrition. I had some encouragement from my sister Erin to switch my major to nutrition, which, you know, I had to kind of start all over. I didn't have a whole lot of classes that really converted over to nutrition school, which was fine. I didn't care. I just wanted to do something that I cared about. And I really like nutrition, actually. I don't want to get like emotional, but I always struggled with body image as a kid. I was probably overweight since third grade. and I always was curious about how food impacted the body. And I think for a long time too, God, I didn't mean to talk about this. I think I always thought that you were kind of dealt one card in life and that you don't have a whole lot of room to control it. So I kind of grew up as like the fat kid and thought that's just what that's just the card that you had dealt. Oh my gosh, sorry. So for a long time, I didn't think that I had any control over that. I was overweight, my heaviest, I won't quote numbers, but I was pretty heavy freshman year of college and just kind of thought, well, that's who I am. I have to be, if I want to stand out, I have to be, you know, like the funny fat girl or something like that. If I thought I had anything, it was creativity and I was sometimes funny. So that's what I had to give to the world. And obviously I think differently now, but yeah, so it was interesting. I found out with nutrition school that, you know, while we all have predispositions to certain body types or genetic disorders, what have you, a healthy diet and a healthy active lifestyle are definitely something that has more to do than how the world views you from a physical standpoint. You know, being healthy and physically active also impacts your longevity and quality of life. It helps you, if you fuel your body right, it helps you to meet certain goals. Like, I'm currently training to run for my second marathon. A lot of people think I'm crazy, and some days I think I'm crazy too, because you're out there for hours hashing out those miles. But I think that's just a testament to kind of celebrating that your body's healthy and that it can do these things that sound outlandish and crazy, especially in August. It's so hot right now. But yeah, anyway, so I switched from business to nutrition and I kind of fell in love. So
I'm going to take you back just a little bit about the cooking and baking, and what is it about baking that kind of, that you loved it so much and they actually encouraged you by buying the ingredients and everything. What was it about baking that you loved?
That's something that's really hard to describe, actually. I think there's just something really satisfying with cooking or baking your own food. And baking is what I started out doing, probably because who doesn't like cake and cookies? some people, I've learned to not indulge in those too much, but I don't know, especially around the holidays, like baking, my mom used to make a big deal about baking cookies for your neighbors or like for people at church. And so we would spend like 2 days baking cookies, like for all day. And we'd have cookies everywhere. And so, you know, we have fun making them and now we have to give them out to all of our neighbors and to people at church. And that was fun. I mean, it's kind of, you spend time with family, I guess, like you're spending time with people that you care about and you're spending time doing this activity that is indescribably satisfying and fun. And then at the end of it all, you know, you're not just keeping it for yourself, you're giving it to someone else, which makes them feel special because, you know, when you look at something like a cookie that is really pretty to look at and hopefully very tasty, you know, that person feels special. They feel like, oh, you spent time out of your day to think of me or to, you know, make sure that I felt special. And so that's not really a direct answer, but that's, I think that's what's fun. And in high school, actually, I had this habit of when it was someone's birthday, a friend's birthday, I would, even if it was 3 a.m, right, as a high school student, I'd be like, I gotta make this thing. And, you know, luckily my family tolerated me. I'd be like in the kitchen making stuff. And I just wanted people to feel special. It was their day. And my family either tolerated it or encouraged it, one or the other. And so I guess that's probably why I think it's fun. I'm a very service-oriented person. It makes me feel better to make someone else feel better. So I guess that's why.
So tell me about, you have a large family, so tell me about the meals or any special meal that you all celebrated or coming together and sitting down and eating at the table and what that meant to the family.
So when my dad was growing up, and I keep forgetting which state it's either, I think it's Iowa. He moved around a fair amount. His dad was a math teacher, but a math teacher in church. So he would move around depending on where he was called to work. And at one point when my dad was in high school, I think it was early high school, my grandfather decided, I'm not going to teach right now. I'm going to make more money. My dad grew up with a large family and not a whole lot of money. And they just, I'm going to start my own business. I'm going to open up a pizza and sub shop. And so some of my favorite foods are the foods that he make at home. And, so he makes like an Italian sub sandwich that you see everywhere. It's like capicola ham, like salami, pepperoni, like pepperoncini, tomatoes, all that delicious. And he also makes, and this is what I think the family really remembers dad for, is pizza. We would make pizza, the dough that he would make and the sauce that he would make, and then we all would just make whatever kind of pizza we want. But it's just, that's such a process to make your own pizza from scratch, especially when there's, like, you know, whatever, Pizza Hut or whatever down the road, that it's, we didn't do it very often, and so that was very special to do at home. And now we do that Christmas Eve. So, and I think of meals that dad made because dad didn't cook as much as mom did. And so maybe that is why it was more special. But, mom's happy because she's not cooking and she's getting food and we're all happy because we get to help in some way. And, dad's pizza crust just tastes better. I don't know.
What was it like to help in the kitchen? What did that, you know, did you enjoy it? Most kids are like, no, I don't want to do that. But you know, why did you enjoy helping in the kitchen? When your dad was cooking, or your mom?
I think that's probably where I probably felt most connected to mom and dad, maybe. I guess. I would say even now that my sisters probably connect best with my mom. like they kind of share just more about their life with mom right now. And I'm just kind of like, I'll let you know when you need to know. And I enjoy quality time with someone more than I enjoy like calling and letting you know what's going on in my life. Although now I'm realizing that maybe as we grow up, that's just as important because there's not as much one-on-one time. But, and then with dad, dad's not one to necessarily hang out with you while you're at home. He's not necessary. There has to be a purpose almost to your one-on-one time. And so if that meant a bike ride, if that means playing games on the computer or watching a movie, then that's all fine. But if he's not interested in whatever activity it is that's going on, he's not necessarily going to join you. I mean, sometimes he will and he's getting better, but, so I think for me, cooking with mom and dad is important because that's something that all of us can connect on and we all enjoy that activity. And so that's probably why.
Okay. So let's talk about when you decided to switch to nutrition, a big change from business.
Yes.
Just a little bit of a switch. How did you know that this was the route you wanted to go?
Well, my sister pointed, I was between kinesiology or nutrition, and nutrition or kinesiology both interested me just because I think they both impacted the body or could at least guide me to understand this kind of giant issue that I didn't really understand, which was my body image issues. And my sister convinced me to go with food because it's what I kind of just gravitated towards naturally. And I enjoyed learning about that. I still enjoy learning anything I can learn about food and the food system. And so it was kind of a no-brainer once my sister helped point that out to me, that this has always been something you've been fascinated by, and so why not go to school and learn about it? So, and from the beginning, like one of the first classes you take is Nutrition 241 or something like a basic human nutrition. You learn about all the nutrients kind of informally, and you learn about how that impacts the body. And it's honestly a lot of information up front. If you knew nothing about metabolism or nutrition, it's a lot to learn at one time. But as you go through the program, you kind of tease out certain disorders and certain nutrients and how that metabolizes in the body. And it's quite frankly fascinating. Although I can understand why some people just don't need to know that much about food and why, like, I need to eat my vegetables and things like that. Some people just, it's just food. I just need it to fuel me so I can do these things that I love. But I'm kind of a nerd in that way, and I just want to know. I just want to know why.
What do you think attributes that fascination with the food, and learning about it, that fueled you to make this switch?
I think this kind of goes back to cooking, and one of the first classes you take too in nutrition is a cooking class. So you learn about the Maillard reaction, about the browning of toast or the browning of meat and the chemical reaction that's taking place there. And you realize that, you know, math and science have a purpose because now it's being tied to cooking, or before, outside of that, it's not very fascinating to me to talk about chemical reactions. You know, okay, great, we made ammonia. It smells gross, and I don't really care, you know. But when you're talking about a cooking reaction and it's related to food, which then is related to people, I think that's then a connection that I'm really on board with. And now I care about the chemistry behind that all. And so I think it was something I thought I would really enjoy. It was certainly hard. I won't say it was easy. But I think it was kind of like worth the hard work for sure.
Any surprises during the nutrition classes that you just did not anticipate?
I definitely didn't expect metabolism to be so difficult. And I kind of wish that I had taken macro before I took micro. For some reason, the catalog has you take micro before macro. And micro is where you learn about every mineral and every nutrient in its significant form. And macro is where you learn about fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. And I just kind of feel like if I had a bigger picture view and then kind of went and looked at the details, it would have probably connected with me better. But you don't really know that until you get into it. Although it kind of makes sense. You take macro before you take micro in economics. I don't know why I didn't think to do that with nutrition, metabolism, but it was certainly difficult. But I was told that from the beginning, and it's rang true for me anyway. And I, what I like about the nutrition field is that it's so diverse. I don't have to stay committed to one particular field if I don't want to. And that's kind of why I think I'm in the position that I'm in now. But I like that kind of flexibility of not having to be locked in as like an accountant for the rest of my life, because there's really no other way to spin. These are my skill sets, and this is what I can offer you as an employee. But I don't know if that really answered your question.
No, that's perfect. So tell me a little bit about being receiving your degree in nutrition. What people don't know about getting this type of degree and what they can do with it.
If you know nothing about nutrition, and the field that it goes in, that you can go into or enter into is, I don't think people realize how science-based it is. And I also don't think people realize how young the field of nutrition is. There's a lot of nutrition misinformation in the world, and everyone's kind of an expert on nutrition because in this world of social media and constant attention to a theory, about nutrition, there's research-based nutrition information that we know about the human body and how it interacts with certain nutrients or certain lifestyle habits. And then there's a lot we don't know. And so in a way, there's a lot of assumptions on how we should carry our body. I mean, we see that too with the change from the My Pyramid to the My Plate. There was a lot of information in the My Period for people to grasp, and it was just really hard for them to kind of adhere to that. Now with My Plate, it's a little bit more simplistic, even though not perfect. It's in their fifth year now with that. I think it's interesting that I kind of feel like nutrition gets attacked a lot just because there is a lot of misinformation out there, or experts or people who maybe don't have a nutrition background. They didn't go through the four-year program, but they've read an article or a blog or picked up some book at Barnes & Noble or what have you. And I now know how the body works. I think there's a huge, huge misunderstanding with that. And even in the field of nutrition, we have dietitians who are experts at weight management or diabetes or renal care or infertility or heart issues. I mean, you can be a cardiac dietitian or a ICU dietitian. You specialize in kind of those trauma care situations. And there's certifications on top of your registered dietetic certification that makes you a specialized person in that field. And I too think, and hopefully this will change, but the people who study nutrition and nutrients and how that affects your body, I think that's also underappreciated even in the clinical realm. And so we have a lot of work in the field of nutrition to kind of get the support that we need, both in clinical care, but also publicly. For the work that we went through with school and all the studying that we do and the nerds that we are about why we care about food and how it affects your body and all of that. So,
did you change once you started down this nutrition field, did you change your habits, your eating habits? Or?
Definitely, yes.
So tell me about that transition.
I've changed a few times, actually. You kind of learn, you experiment on yourself, kind of. No one else is going to follow this diet I decided to come up with. But this is actually something my family and I, we all joke about. When I was in business school, you're so kind of financially motivated to save money, make money, invest money, that I was really trying, and I was out of mom and dad's house. I was like really trying to be good with money and be a good steward of money. And, you know, I did have to take out loans and things like that. So I was just like, okay, I'm going to save and do really well. And they called me the dollar queen because I wouldn't buy anything that wasn't a dollar. I mean, I'm talking vegetables, milk, protein. I didn't buy it if it wasn't a dollar because it was too much. And I always left the grocery store like under $12. And that's what I would eat for most of the week. And let me tell you, you're not buying the best foods when you're a dollar queen. So that was probably the biggest change that happened when I came into nutrition school and kind of learned about what it is that most American or the American diet and what most Americans aren't getting. And now I'm probably a huge advocate of eating your fruits and vegetables, but also focusing on fiber. Not that fiber is going to change the world, but I think it's something that people don't focus enough on, and it's really good for colon care. But when your colon is healthy, you have a better immune defense system, and so I just feel like we don't focus enough on that. A lot of people are really focused on things like protein. Fruits and vegetables obviously do have fiber in it, but so do beans, legumes, whole grains. And I don't know. That's probably what I focus on the most now, but the biggest change was the high sodium processed items that you could get for a dollar when it's on sale or manager special or what have you. And I didn't really focus too much about having a complete meal or making sure I had my fruits and vegetables. That was not a focus. It was, can I leave the grocery store in $10 or less?
That's skill right there. So let's talk a little bit about, I have two kind of questions that are not in the same area whatsoever. I hear a lot of business kind of entrepreneurship talk and coming from you. How do you think that skill set has helped you along the path that you've chosen to take?
So I ended up getting a business minor because I felt like, well, what's three more classes? And let's just lock that in into a minor. Although looking back, I kind of wish that I had studied supply chain management. But that would have meant like an additional year and a half, probably more. And I was like, kind of over school right now. I'm not sure if that would have particularly helped me. Supply chain management, I think, focused a lot more on how you save a business money by reducing mileage or packaging materials and all of that. But I think it would have given me a better foundation from the beginning, considering where I started from, about the industry and why it's kind of manifested into the way that it is. I mean, when we talk about sustainability in the food system, and much like in business, it comes down to financial incentives to get people to do the things that you want them to do. It's not always about kind of, you've heard probably of the triple bottom line of doing what's good for your business, but also what's good for the community around you. And I don't know that most large businesses necessarily have that in mind. It seems to be very much, how is this going to impact my financial bottom line? And that's nice if I can do that and still make my profit margins. But if I can't, then it's not going to be a priority for me. And I think that's something I really struggle with. But at the same time, given the limited business background that I have, I guess it makes sense. I mean, as a world, I think a lot of us are financially motivated, and that's kind of a way that we identify as success. If my business can get to just, you know, one more stock level or what have you, we're then successful. But at some point, and this is just kind of how economics works, you can only get so high, and at some point you're going to come down. Don't know when that's going to happen, but at some point it's going to come down. And so when we talk about sustainability, I kind of wonder if businesses, especially newer businesses who are kind of triple bottom line oriented, are thinking about how can we sustain success, make what we need, and is success then identified by how can we take care of our employees and the community around us and make sure that the needs of the community are being met outside of, like, you know, our financial profit margin gains. I forgot the question.
No, it's perfect. Just to kind of the business skill set and how that has impacted.
So I guess that's probably why when I'm talking with industry about bringing on more local producers so that schools have access to it, or what do you need, distributor, to bring on a local farm? How can we make that happen? What's the reality of that actually happening, as opposed to you maybe doing it once and it being a flash in the pan kind of business venture view because it looks good goodwill wise, but it's not really helping maybe that producer or that school, you know, at all. I think it helps me to talk with industry in a way that they'll stay involved in the conversation. I think it would be a disservice to go in kind of naively thinking that everyone is interested in servicing their community for the community's sake and not just for like a financial incentive. And so what I do and what I've learned is that you need to work in the system to make changes in the system. You kind of have to use your business savvy or your this is going to sound bad, but your manipulative skills to kind of help make that change happen and make it sound appealing to the people who really can make that change happen. So one of the things that I'm hoping will work out I guess I should explain a little bit what I do is before I can.
Okay, go so on. I'll have you wait then, because I have one more quick question. When you go and talk to industry, and they're thinking a nutritionist is coming to them, and you actually start talking about supply and demand and kind of the business angle, are they surprised, and what is that kind of reaction?
Honestly, I've had more pushback because I am young and I look very young. I think more than what background do you have. Initially, when I first started, I had a nutrition background and I was speaking with I was trying to get some of our agricultural experts at the table to talk about how I'm going to do this and what's the reality of the food system here in Arizona and like what did I get myself into, kind of a thing. And I don't know that I had pushback about the fact that I don't have an agriculture background, because my intention was to feed kids healthy food and to bring Arizona agriculture into the forefront in a way that hadn't been really discussed in Arizona before. So I probably used my skills there a little bit to kind of help make that okay. I wouldn't say industry is necessarily concerned about the fact that I have a small business background, but I don't know that that's like a deterrent for them. Like I said, I think they're more interested in how maybe is this going to make me money or how is this going to make my business stronger, more than what background do you have and what right do you have to come talk to me about my business and changing my business.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about, since you were calling yourself the Dollar Queen, tell me a little bit about how being the Dollar Queen has helped you understand kind of the food injustice or the problems with food for people that are on a limited budget and similar to you, they have to watch had to watch what you purchased and you didn't necessarily purchase
healthy
fruit, vegetables,
right.
You purchase high calorie content. And so tell me how that doing that has helped you kind of frame where you are now today.
I think that it just allows me more empathy when I'm working in that population. As you probably know, the National School Lunch Program is an anti-hunger program, and so that's the population that I am working with for the majority. And so when we're giving advice to people about changing the way they practice their business, we have to be mindful of that. Food service directors do not have a lot of extra cash to be buying kind of heritage grains or heritage lettuces or, you know, these kind of special products that you would normally see in maybe a high-end restaurant. And so I have to be respectful of that and understand the reality of maybe bringing that in as a trial situation or what resources do you really have to making something like this work, because the end-all result is that students will be more connected with their food and then hopefully eat more of those fresh foods that we want them to eat, especially those low-income populations that maybe don't have access to that at home. And so it's really important that we give them the best meal we can at school. But I think grocery shopping is one of my favorite things to do, by the way. A lot of people hate grocery shopping. I find it fascinating. And maybe it's because the world, that is such an expansive world that's constantly changing. And the marketing that goes on in a grocery store is constantly changing. It's ambiguous too. And people just get really confused and nervous. But instead, I like dive into it. And I for some reason, I'm just fascinated. I mean, you see products on the shelf too that come in, you know, being really great, popular for maybe a couple of years, and then you never see it again. And that all has to do with kind of business and how we market food and all of that. But I don't know. I just think it's interesting and fascinating. And you also see, too, like kale coming up in population and quinoa coming up in population with people because of, you know, kind of the foodie world, or maybe we're claiming it's very more nutrient dense than maybe something else. And I think that's fascinating too. In some ways that's good, in some ways that's bad. Especially when we're talking about low income populations, you know, do I really have access to something like quinoa? And is it worth it to me to buy something like quinoa that's more expensive as a grain than something like brown rice or barley wheat berries, things like that. What can I do as maybe someone who doesn't have a lot of money, invest in the food that I'm eating that then will keep me healthy and my family healthy, outside of these trend foods that kind of make a splash every year. So I think that my Dollar Queen day is just, it just helps me, I think, empathize with people who don't have a whole lot of money. And I'm definitely getting back to there, I think, for a while too, because I'm, you know, had a job and had more money. I was fascinated by this creative culture of food and probably invested a lot more money and time and energy into kind of exploring that area, only to realize that I really like and enjoy cooking and would rather, in a lot of cases nowadays, cook at home and come up with my own creations with what I have at home, and be just as pleasantly surprised and happy than going out to a restaurant and having to get dressed up, or, you know, the event of going out to eat. And I would rather just kick it at home and make something happen there. And plus you did it yourself, so that's kind of, you know, encouraging as well.
So I'm going to ask you now, how did you become involved in your current organization?
So it's a weird kind of thing. One of the first things we had to do in nutrition school was spend, I think it was something like 90 hours in the community. No, it was only like 12. It was only 12 hours. It was a community nutrition class. We had to spend 12 hours in the community. It could be like a food bank. I ended up at the farmer's market with Cindy, which is where I first met her. I didn't even know what a farmer's market was. I didn't know that those things existed. I was so outside of my realm, but excited about it at the same time. I didn't know, like most Arizonans, didn't know that we grew things here. I was like, and I've lived here my whole life. Arizona's a desert. There's no way we're growing anything but cactus and tumbleweeds, because I've lived behind a desert that's now developed, but I was like, nothing grew out there. Promise you. But obviously that's not true. And I've learned that over the years. So I started with Cindy, 12 hours. I think I had to get that done in a semester. It was a very kind project, actually, whatever worked out for both Cindy and myself. And she was working at the Phoenix Public Market at the time. And so she had every weekend I could come out, and it was like 5 or 6 hours a slot. So I really only had to be there for two weekends probably. I ended up staying. They seemed to need my help, and I really like helping people. So I stayed on for a couple years and helped recruit more volunteers. And I learned a lot while I was there with Cindy about smaller producers and also the low-income population. I was really just at the information booth unless I had some special projects that needed to be done on the weekend. And so we had customers who had EBT cards, and it was really kind of cool because we would just scan that like a debit card, and like they didn't have to feel weird about shopping at the farmer's market, which was awesome. And so and then the purpose of this volunteer work was to give us direct exposure to a community in need, which is what we spent a lot of our time talking about in community nutrition, and what those programs really look like, and kind of meet the people that were those assistance programs kind of touch base with real life people. And I think that's important for all dietitians to know, not only because they're going to be in every community that you work in, but also there's a special caveat on how you need to treat that population too. Like they have little and often less than I do. And I think it's important to treat them with respect. They're there asking for help because they are often working poor. They're not making enough to buy food, but maybe enough to cover whatever rent that they need to cover, a lot of them have families and need to help those kids thrive, and maybe they are themselves sacrificing meals so that their children can eat, or whatever the situation is. And I think that we come across these people in general in our daily life, and I think a lot of the time sometimes they're disrespected or kind of forgotten. They're kind of invisible because it's easier to not think about that kind of human kindness. But so anyway, from there, I also have a child nutrition certificate that I got through ASU as I was finishing up my minor. Why not get a certificate? I was able to work with the Department of Education as an intern. And so there I learned about things like the USDA Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Program, the USDA Healthier School Challenge. Yes, I said that right. Which is just an incentive program for schools who are excelling in their meal program and their physical activity components at school to get an award that recognizes their work outside of those in the community who maybe are kind of doing maybe not the bare minimum, but, you know, they meet the needs of what it is that their program is supposed to do. We really want to exemplify those who are kind of going above and beyond for the health of their community and also the Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Grant program. So I was learning some little programs that were beyond National School Lunch or School Breakfast. And I was with them for about 2 months, probably once a week. So I got a lot of time with them, and kind of from there, I was then beginning to read articles from my professional organization, now the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, about farm to school. And so I was like, what is that? So my grandfather, on my mom's side, had a farm. He was a cattleman, and he also rose his own grain for that cattle. And so we are fond of Little Blue Hill, Nebraska, where his farm was. And now that I know more about agriculture, he was a smaller producer, very humble, had all girls, so no one took over the farm. although that's the case a lot these days. So that was like the most agriculture that I had grown up with. I mean, Grandpa had a farm, and like, I didn't realize, I don't think, that a lot of my friends growing up didn't have that same exposure to agriculture. It was just, that was kind of normal. Grandma had a garden, Mom had a garden here and there. And so it wasn't very significant to me, but when I saw that article about farm to school, I was like, well, this is interesting. And I asked the director of that program who was going to hire this person to do farm to school. What is Arizona doing in farm to school? Like, what? I didn't know we grew stuff here. What does that look like? And I'm asking all these questions, and they couldn't answer because they're like, well, that's why we're actually hiring someone, because we need this to be an initiative in our school program, but we don't know how to answer these questions. And we're getting questions about school garden development, and we just realized that the background of most of our professionals, you know, and the connections that they have are limited. We can't answer those questions, and so we're basically creating a position to help bridge that gap. And so as USDA slowly took on this initiative in school lunch, ADE did the same thing. And so I applied, didn't think I was going to get it. I was like, if I don't get this, I'm going to go do my internship for my registered dietitian certificate. I didn't even make it to actually applying formally. So applications were due in February. I graduated in December. I applied, kind of waited around for a month. And then they picked me. I don't really know why, honestly, because I don't really know who I was in competition with, but I can imagine a fresh out from nutrition school with no ag background really fit the bill, except that I remember there was a question in the interview about, are you comfortable with gray? Like, with an ambiguity? Like, are you comfortable with not having a black and white? And if you've ever met a dietitian, most of them are black and white. There's going to be a black and white answer. There's going to be evidence to support this. And I just don't see the world that way. And so I was completely okay with gray. And that I'm guessing, I don't really know this for sure, but I'm guessing that's probably why I got the job. And also, probably being younger, I was someone that could be manipulated to doing and being whoever the agency needed me to be, as opposed to maybe someone who was older and more kind of set in their ways. They didn't want to have to deal with the pushback. But that's kind of the story of how I got there.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about the job and what it is and the goals and the mission of the farm school.
So the agency's mission and goals is to create an excellent environment for academic success. So that's supporting our teachers and supporting our students, making sure that everyone is academically successful. In health and nutrition, we want to make sure that students are well-fed so that they can be focused and ready to learn in the classroom. And Farm to School, honestly, has the same goals. A lot of nutrition educators, we have SNAP Ed, which is an education program under the Arizona Nutrition Network that works in schools of 50% free and reduced and below to make sure that those students have nutrition education continuously. They work on policies. They work on settings of the school to make sure that it's a healthy one so that physical activity is not only present but also encouraged to meet a certain standard every year or every week, and also that there's nutrition education opportunities for students to learn about what's good for them and their body. Health classes and PE classes have kind of been cut out of the system as academic has become more of the forefront and focus. That's not true of all of our schools, but a lot of our schools, when you got to cut funding, you kind of cut those special areas that help make a student more well-rounded. And quite frankly, for those kinesthetic learners who need hands-on development or learn outside of written or verbal communication, you're kind of doing a disservice for them to cutting out those kind of creative elements to where they are more free to think the way that they're comfortable thinking, and forcing them instead to think in a way that they're less likely to probably be successful. Farm to School helps in those ways. Farm to School is honestly just one method that you can use to get a child to connect with food. Cooking, which doesn't necessarily have to be Farm to School related, can be that for many students and adults, actually, to connect with their food. They enjoy the process of eating is now more satisfying because I helped prepare this meal. And I almost have more value tied to this meal because I spent 30 minutes to an hour or whatever it took to cook this meal, as opposed to just getting it in 5 minutes from the drive-thru window or from some counter or opening up a chip bag, whatever. And the same thing can be said of Farm to School programs. The reason why it's kind of just blown up in the last, I'd say, 5 years or 10 years is because there's a lot of research to show that through social cognitive theory, students who are able to kind of touch and feel and smell and taste their food, especially the fruits and vegetables, that they're more likely to consume those items. I mean, there's lots of research to show that students who maybe didn't like things like broccoli or asparagus or cauliflower or beets, these are all foods that we kind of associate with kids maybe not particularly liking, and for a lot of adults probably not liking either. But these kids are then growing it themselves. They're watching this plant grow that, you know, in often cases takes anywhere from like 30 to 90 days to mature to a place where you can eat it. And so you've kind of grown along with this plant and you eat it for the first time. And not only does it taste better because it's fresher, but you are more open-minded to trying that item and accepting it as something that maybe you could put into your regular repertoire of food. So school gardening is huge in Arizona, but also nationally. And gardens are starting to become more popular even at homes. Community gardening is very popular, I think, for those reasons. And there's just kind of a direct connection with that. You see a direct impact with students who are gardening themselves and then being more open-minded with food. The same thing can be said of students who are exposed to meeting their producer either through farm tours or through videos of where they're seeing what's happening on a farm and how growing a broccoli plant or a lettuce plant, you know, actually ends up on your plate, and you kind of have a deeper connection and you find that there's more value to that. This food item that maybe I didn't like and I just threw in the trash or gave to my dog or whatever. I think that is one of the reasons why I think this program is so important, but also just why it's so impactful. It's just neat. And me, even knowing that my grandpa had cattle and grandma had a farm, and I didn't like asparagus when I was a kid. I was like, it looks cool, and it takes like 2 years for it to produce anything. So when I was
cutting all this asparagus for grandma, and she was like, oh, you're not eating any. And I was like, oh, no, I don't like asparagus. I just wanted to cut it all. You know, her heart probably broke because she was like, now we have to eat so much asparagus. This kid won't even eat it.
So let me ask you a little bit about you saying the school gardening, and tell me a little bit about what that initiative is and your role in that.
So unfortunately, my role is, I think, a little indirect. Well, it is. It's indirect. I think a lot of people, when I first started, I had people call me up and be like, okay, I'm ready for the school garden to be dropped in. When could you be here during the month? And I was like, it's frankly more complicated than that. So I really provide, I'm more of a resource provider for schools who want to start a school garden. I also go out and visit school gardens. I give them advice based off of things I learned from cooperative extension or just going out on site visits, and really help people kind of brainstorm about how they can start or expand their school garden. I can connect one school garden to another, let's say. So earlier this year, we had a school who was struggling with their administration to get citrus trees put into their yard. And their concern was that maintenance was going to have to take care of it instead of the garden leaders. And they wanted an example of a school that had citrus in their garden. And for some reason, they wanted an example, which was actually kind of hard to find. We found one for them to then, the administrators, to then talk about, you know, what does this take? Citrus trees, like a lot of fruit trees, actually do take a lot more water. And so I don't know if that was really the concern. And as far as maintenance, you do want to make sure that you're taking care of the fruit and harvesting it when it's available, because you want to avoid certain pests. So pest management might have been another issue, but so that's something that I do. And also, whenever grants come out, I want to make sure that our schools know about it. Western Growers Foundation has received specialty crop block funding, which is from our Department of Agriculture and from our American Marketing Service, but funds to get gardens started or expanded in Arizona. And so they service Arizona and California, and they've been putting out, I think now it's $1,000, but it used to be $1,500 per school garden, K-12. And, you know, my job then is to make sure that schools apply. And interestingly, we've struggled the last few years to get schools to apply. I'm like, guys, this is easy money. We're not even competing with national markets anymore. Like, we're just competing with ourselves. Like, just apply. You'll probably get it.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think when you're writing a grant, so it's kind of grandiose, especially if you're not used to writing a grant. And it may even be easier just to ask for donation within your community from garden supply centers. A lot of people want to start or help support school gardens because it impacts kids. And so that might be a reason. Or maybe the PTA or school has a special pot of funding, which I should say that kind of jokingly, knowing that a lot of our schools don't have a lot of extra money. But I think maybe in some ways, because I know the PTA or because I know maybe my community garden center, maybe it's easier to think of doing that. But I mean, also, quite frankly, starting a school garden, if you know nothing about gardening or even like where to go, is quite daunting. And thinking that you might have to then shoulder this project, which, you know, a lot of school gardens are kind of flash in the pan projects because it is a lot of work. And if you are the only one doing it, you're going to burn out. Like, that's just the story. Unless you have a huge passion for kids and gardening, it's just something that's going to falter unless you get more people to help you out. Because it's a lot of work, and you really want students to be connected to that garden. That's in a lot of ways why schools start gardens, for the educational aspect. And so, I think that. So anyway, my role really is to just talk with school gardens or people who want to start school gardens, let them know of Cooperative Extension and the Valley Permaculture Alliance. And we have a lot of seed libraries specifically for schools where they can check out seeds, and they kind of let their plant go to seed, and they collect them and then kind of give them back and try a new plant in the next season. And it really just offers schools an opportunity to kind of learn through like research and development, like what works for them, what worked for them, and what they're going to continue doing. But all in all, it's the purpose of school gardening is just to kind of learn. you don't have to meet a certain yield. You're not a farm. You're just learning about seed cycles and plant life cycles, and also hopefully getting kids to really connect with food so that they are more likely to eat those foods. Like if they're served at home, we're served on the lunch line. So that's kind of...
Okay. So tell me a little bit, how hard is it not to go into these schools and just go look? This isn't hard if you just, and to actually get in there and everything. I mean, you can provide resources, but it's right. also the next step.
Right.
And how hard is it for you just to not kind of...
It's super frustrating sometimes, even when I talk about local purchasing. While I understand probably more than a school would up front, like the difficulty of accessing local product, I also can only do so much to make that change happen. It takes a school or several schools, and for that matter, to kind of change the demand and supply system of creating that change to happen. And I am only me. I'm only one person, and what I say can only go so far. Whereas schools are an entire community, and they have more weight than I do. I, at least that's how I feel. And so sometimes it is difficult for me to be like, okay, like I could give you a step guide. This is what you need to do. It's kind of that saying, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink it. And so that's kind of how I feel sometimes. What I've definitely felt in my career here at the department is how slow it takes for a change to happen. And while you can do all the research you can and be like, this is all you got to do, this 10-step plan will look different school to school, district to district, producer to producer. What incentivizes them and what encourages them to make those changes, or what they even get out of the entire process, is going to be different every single time. And that's something that's hard for me to gauge. I can't predict that. And so it kind of makes motivating people to act and change and do something different very difficult, only because I know that if I were to decide I'm going to go and put a garden in every single school garden or every single school, or if I'm going to make sure that our producers are connected to a school, or each school has a producer in their area that they can be connected to. I can't even imagine the amount of work that would take. I feel like that would take 100,000 years to do. Just knowing how relationships develop and the whole trust aspect of actually getting that to happen. I mean, relationships literally don't develop out of thin air. They just don't. No matter how great the end result may or may not be, there's a lot of distrust in me saying that children are going to eat their broccoli if you start a school garden. There's a lot of distrust there because, I don't know that that's true, and I don't know if I believe you when you say that. Even if I could show you evidence that it's happened in other states, it's really difficult to get someone to be like, where did it happen in Arizona? And I have more success stories, so it's getting a little easier to kind of help motivate people. But getting those trailblazers out there is really difficult. Who wants to do something that they've never done before and it might not work out? Anyone? Anyone? I'm your girl. I'll help you out. I'll hold your hand, but you got to be ready to help me convince your entire administration that this is a great idea, and I'll be there and I'll help you. But no, so you go figure.
Share with me a success story that you had of a school that's taken this on.
I've worked very closely with Tempe School District. And I don't know that I've necessarily been directly responsible for their success. I think that schools are successful on their own. At the end of the day, they're the ones doing the work, and I'm more the person to just call up when you're having a bad day and, you know, kind of reassure you that this is a good idea and that this will work out. But Tempe School District, I've highlighted again and again, and Linda probably won't be happy that I'm highlighting her again, but... she's bought local apples in the fall to highlight, you know, the fall harvest, which is not a top commodity here in Arizona. It's certainly not. When you think of apples, you do not think of Arizona. You think of Washington.
But she does it because she thinks it's important to connect kids with agriculture and with fresh tasting food. And if kids are even willing just to try the bite of apple, even though this cost me 30 cents more per apple than what I would normally buy, she thinks it's worth it because kids had one more bite of nutrition than they might not have had otherwise. And they had an experience that they might not have had otherwise. And she's also been a huge trooper in the realm of local procurement. Which is a kind of a special caveat that schools have to work under when they're trying to buy anything, but are particularly something local. It kind of fits under that specialized product category, which if you don't have the money to cover, it's not something that you're willing to try. So she's attempted to buy local carrots out directly, outside of her normal produce bid, and she hasn't been successful, but she's tried. I guess that's not a success story, but I think getting someone to try something outside of what they would have normally tried, to me is successful. And we do have, anyway, so we were able to get those carrots through a program of the USDA Foods Program, our Department of Defense Fresh Produce Program. So in a nutshell, we were successful. We had to choose a different route to get the product there. And we also were able to get more schools access to it. So, I mean, it was for naught. We also have a school in Tucson, which again, I want to say I was indirectly involved with. I was more involved with the Community Food Bank, who's a really huge supporter of Tucson Unified School District. And they are, this first year, won a contract with Tucson to kind of aggregate and bring local food for taste tests. So on a small scale, they're about 90 sites, so they have the demand to kind of ask for things that maybe they're not already getting, but for other reasons are unsuccessful in that route. And so on a smaller scale, they have several sites under them that are part of the Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Grant Program, which is a great opportunity for schools, if you're able to access that program, to start buying local on a small level. And also, what better way than outside of a meal, which can be kind of intimidating if you're trying to talk about food and nutrition, to picking one item, focusing on why it's good for you, where it came from, and building that connection with that one food, as opposed to one food that maybe you're focusing on in an entire meal. Especially if you're super hungry, you're just trying to get food in your belly. So that's a success story. So
what are the challenges?
My favorite. So farm to school kind of has five challenges. There's the cost piece, there's the distribution or aggregation or food access piece, there's procurement, that can be a barrier, supply size can be a barrier, and I'll talk about that. What's the fifth one? Food safety. Love that topic. And by love, I mean not really. So all those barriers are certainly true in Arizona in getting access to local food. Probably the ones that are the biggest challenges, that are the hardest to overcome, is the distribution aspect, and that kind of ties to like food safety and supply size. So distributors, schools want to buy like any other buyer, want to buy from one place. That's just kind of the culture that we've set up in this world, and it's easier and it takes time to buy from multiple people. I'd rather just buy from one. If you go to a grocery store, I mean, you used to have to go to the meat market and the bread store and maybe the farmer's market or whatever. You have to go to several places. It was an entire day to get food for the week. So I can imagine, I mean, I would love that. It's amazing, but not everyone wants to do that. And so grocery stores, you know, kind of fit a need for busy families. And so it's completely unrealistic to think that schools would want to go buy from multiple sources of food, especially when you have to follow certain procurement processes to make that happen as well. So the barrier we see a lot in Arizona is we have a lot of small producers and a lot of large producers, but not a whole lot of middle of the road. Our larger producers are kind of set up for export. Most of their stuff is contracted before it's even planted. And whatever's left over is really a smart business move for our farmers in case yields don't happen, or if they have product that something happened to is heaven of the field, they can still give to their promises to whoever they've contracted with internationally or nationally.
So that happens a lot. We also have small producers who are set up for farmers markets, basically. They don't have a whole lot of acreage or a lot of yield in their supplier. They have a really diverse portfolio, and so they're growing a little supply of a lot of different things, which is great. I mean, that's really fun. But in terms of making that like a good venture for schools, that's difficult. A lot of our schools are concerned about the supply that they're going to need, especially our larger districts who have several sites underneath them. And they're like, well, if I buy this, I want to be able to menu it for all of my schools. And I have 60, 80, 90, whatever sites underneath me, even 20 would be a lot. And that's just not realistic for me. I can't have a different menu for every single school. Like, I have a hard enough time getting the same menu out to all my schools and having that go seamlessly. So that's a barrier. And that's like a food system issue, which is where I think schools, if they band together or if we have larger districts who make that initiative or make create that demand, industry will follow, because industry is going to be tied to money. And school industry is tied to schools because there's a lot of money there. And while schools can't afford the top-of-the-line products, I mean, we're not serving like sirloin steaks or anything to kids anytime soon, even those who could probably pay for it. You have a certain demand or a buying power that a small charter or a smaller school district just could never actually call that demand for, especially in the realm of produce. I mean, some of our districts who aren't, I wouldn't say small, but are small in the eyes of industry, 20 sites, let's say, doesn't have the buying power or demand to say, I want X amount of lettuce, which means let's say they swapped out a lettuce, local, whatever. They're still not buying enough for industry to make that worth their time. Now, if we had 5 or 10 different districts claiming for the same product, then we're talking enough money to where it's kind of dumb business-wise to not invest in that new product or whatever that schools are looking for. So something I'm really excited about that I hope we get done by October or by the end of the year is a group purchasing pilot with a few of our districts. And I say group purchasing, we have a lot of group purchasing cooperatives in the state for schools. They kind of band together, buy one thing, and they get a reduced price because they have so much money they're putting on the table that whoever is winning that contract or that bid, I can't say no, because I'm getting so much money from you, basically. That's a large account. I can't afford to say no. And I didn't realize this was an issue, I don't think, until I had some schools actually go out and try to buy certain things local, and they were unsuccessful in getting responses. And so it's like, okay, well, we clearly don't have enough money on the table then to make anyone listen. So I'm really excited about this group purchasing pilot. And we actually have a meeting about it with a couple of our school districts who are doing this next month. And I'm hoping it's really successful, because we've promised that by buying together, we can not only reduce the price, but get access to things that you've been unable to access in the past. And I think that if that's successful, we're on the brink of a larger food system change, at least for schools, to accessing products that's going to make a difference in their meal program. So
tell me how you came about this group purchasing pilot, and what are the items they're going to purchase?
So this is a concept that you see in business, especially school business in general. And this happens too in farm-to-school programs around where it's an issue of, I don't have a lot of small producers near me. And so, for example, in Vermont, there's a lot of smaller producers there. There's not a whole lot of large producers. And so a small farmer getting a contract with a school is like really sweet business, because now I don't have to go to the market as much. And a school, especially probably in Vermont, they're willing to take kind of the ugly product that, you know, someone at a farmer's market probably wouldn't take. And so I'm going to turn that into lasagna or whatever it is. And the school's happy, the farmer's happy, and that works really well. And while we have small and large producers here, getting the buy-in to kind of make that change can be difficult without like a guarantee that this is going to help sustain my business or help take some like farmers markets off my docket. And with schools too, them being concerned about meeting supply or will my kids even eat this? Like, is this just going to go into the trash? And also it's not like a very streamlined approach, which they're very used to buying things kind of once a year and getting that year round, and like worst case scenario, having to switch out a menu item because something didn't come through. And like that is a big hurdle in school food in general. So like, why would I want to invite more fires to put out? Like, I totally understand that. You're right. That sounds awful. And so we had talked about a couple of things for this purchasing pilot. I'm hoping that we can access apples. We have a couple apple growers down south, and I believe one up north. And they say they can give us a truckload of apples if a school buys it. If this group purchasing pilot can buy a truckload of apples, we have something to negotiate with. That's apparently a quantity that perks the ears up of industry and of some of our producers who maybe, if you couldn't meet the cost that they were asking for, wouldn't really be into negotiating. Like, look, if you can't give me 60 cents per apple, then I don't know if I want to help you, you know? We've talked about like lettuces in the wintertime. November through April is like our large lettuce season, basically because we're not frozen over like a lot of other places. So we're producing a lot of lettuces throughout the year. I think we've also talked about things like tomatoes. It's really dependent on what all the schools can agree on that they could buy a truckload of. I'm hoping it's apples because it's a nice storage crop, so you don't have to utilize it really quickly, which means we don't have to worry so much about... that means schools can ask for more up front in one buy, basically. And we don't have to worry about multiple deliveries. We get one delivery per school site. It's a storage crop, and so we don't have to worry too much about it. Another thing that I might suggest, but this would require some menu enhancements, would be something like a winter squash or a pumpkin or something like that. So to be determined what will actually happen, but I'm really excited about that.
How long did it take to put this pilot together and all the people, to bring all the people to the table?
So I proposed the question probably earlier this year. One of our school districts they had changed out their procurement person. And so that took a little bit of a while. We had to get the, whatever that transition had to happen. And then we had to kind of spin it to this procurement person. And luckily this procurement person was very interested in doing something different. I mean, if it's going to get you the product that you want, in her mind, that's what I'm here for. She was fine doing something outside of the norm, which I wouldn't say is the call of duty of a lot of procurement people. And luckily she knows her research. She knows her stuff. She's like, here's the limitations. I had to sit down and kind of train and discuss what options you have, kind of legally to go about this. Here are the loopholes. Essentially, this is what you need to think about when you're rewriting your documents. And then you practice the procurement as you would anything else. She became on board very quickly, and then it became more of a process of getting other school districts to get excited about it. So I'd say it's probably taken 8 months to do that, and now we're having a meeting in September. And hopefully the procurement will take place before the end of the year, I'm hoping.
So let's go back to, you mentioned five challenges, you talked about distribution, and then hadn't really touched on the other ones, but just briefly, I mean, you talked about distribution, but like safety and the other challenges.
So food safety is kind of a concern. What's different about Arizona than other states, it seems, is a lot. So we are a local regulatory state. A lot of our local county health departments are the ones who kind of decide what food code we use and how we interpret what that means and what that says. The Arizona Food Code has a line about approved source, which there's no definition as to what that means, but the interpretation really is, are you food safety certified or not, is what it comes down to. It's not written that that's what they mean. And when you talk to different counties, it kind of means different things to different counties or even to different representatives that you talk to from the county. But in general, we've, I think, gotten most of our counties to agree that food safety approved source, for the most part, means some sort of food safety certification. The bare minimum tends to be the USDA GIPGAP, which is good handling practices and good agricultural practices. It's a kind of baseline food safety certification for produce. And then there's higher level ones where you get like a third party audit from like Primus Labs or something like that, basically saying that we have the best food safety you have. And most distributors will take anything from GAP to some sort of third party auditor. Now, in other states with farm to school, it tends to be the case that in lieu of a food safety certification for a small producer, that can be really resource intensive. It can take a lot of time. It can take a lot of money. And there's not a guarantee that you're going to make that money back working with an institution. Although, ideally, if you had a good relationship with an institution, you would make that money back tenfold outside of a farmer's market. But anyway, other states have these like food safety checklists that they go through with the producer. So the buyer and the producer are together talking about your food safety practices. They check, decide that we're okay with it, and they both sign off. And that's supposed to act as like a legal document in the case or the event or in the event of like a food recall. Some people might argue that that's not going to hold up in court or that that's not really going to protect you from a risk management perspective on the schools. A lot of our schools want to err on the side of caution, particularly because we're talking about students, but I think also just because the liability risk is really, can potentially be really heavy. And so many of our schools prefer to buy or look for local from a GIPGAP or above certified farm. Some aren't necessarily like, some of our schools know their producers well and want to buy. So we have some counties that are more restrictive, will not let a school buy outside of GIPGAP or above. And then we have some counties who kind of just don't want to be the bad guy, which I probably even shouldn't even say on this, but like kind of don't want to be the bad guy. And so they kind of say, well, technically, we wouldn't necessarily know who you're buying from or where you're getting it and if they meet all these certifications. Because when we come and inspect your kitchens, we're just making sure that you hit, you know, these marks and that everything looks clean and all of that. But we're not like looking through your invoices and then checking to see if like those people are food safety certified. So we recommend that you buy from someone who's food safety certified. But if you choose not to, we recommend that you cook these items. And a lot of the items that schools want to buy local are something you would serve raw. And so it's kind of an interesting point. And so anyway, most of our schools just kind of prefer to err on the side of caution, or if they are comfortable with their producers and their food safety practices, are literally not allowed to buy anything depending on the county that they're in. So that is certainly a barrier. But for the most part, schools aren't going to buy directly from a farm. Unless it's for a special event, which doesn't happen very frequently, they would buy more of a particular farm's product or local in general if they could get it from their main produce distributor. So that's kind of the overlying challenge that I see. And that's what I mean by working within the system, is getting distributors to want to pick up local product and making that worthwhile for them. But that means guaranteeing in a way that multiple schools are going to be interested in that product. So buying direct does happen occasionally, especially if the product is, you know, cost effective enough or it's really going to impact your food service operation. And those are just kind of special cases. But if we're looking for, you know, sustainability, you really want to look at what frequent purchases are going to happen and in what system is that going to really happen. And so it kind of falters to who's going to distribute that food.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about... So you've been there 5 years. What do you hope to see happen down the road with this program?
I would really like to see more schools ask for local, but formally in procurement documents. That's going to be kind of the legal standing way for them to show that their demand means something, because that's something they're going to practice. Everyone wants to get into schools. You're going to get a huge count if you get into a school, especially a larger school, or if you have a pocket of schools who's associated with one particular entity, like a lot of our charters, or some of our charters, I shouldn't say a lot. If you can seal the deal on that, or even some of our food service management companies, if you can get in to those areas, those are large accounts and you can't afford to not do that. But you're not going to make that switch or make that move until you're financially motivated to do that. And so you're not going to do that as an industry person unless you see that demand written in contract, essentially, which is kind of a shame because that means you have to kind of change a whole fleet of procurement practice to change. So hopefully we have our procurement directors are more comfortable with adding a local preference for certain items. Hopefully industry is carrying a local line of something and they're able to share and communicate that information to the schools that they're serving. And I also hope too, and this is kind of a similar point, that we're able to carry more direct farm product through our DoD catalog, which is an easy access point for our schools. And also that our group purchasing co-ops that have large accounts with many schools are able to kind of change that demand because they have so many schools that contract with them every single year. So I'm hoping that priorities kind of shift in local purchasing and on the realm of school gardens. I would like to see more educational-based school gardens. We also, and I didn't mention this earlier, have some school gardens who are doing a garden to cafe program. And there's a special food safety certification for schools. It's free, and our Department of Health runs that program. But we have some schools who really just want to have kids see things being grown and then having it being served in the cafeteria to kind of bring a full circle effect back to that student. And so we have a few who are interested in doing that, but most schools are interested in the educational aspect of the garden and not necessarily want to be like a micro farm or, you know, to be production heavy. So I would like to see more of that happen. We have so many different climates in Arizona too. So up north, you know, our growing season is about April to October because it's just too cold to grow anything the rest of the year. And so that's, you know, really much the end of the school year and the front of the school year where schools have access to be growing things. And then there's summer programs that happen. So summer camps or community gardens that happen where kids have a place to kind of learn and play in the dirt. And then our growing season down here is mostly out during the school season, which is remarkable compared to a lot of places in the nation, which is kind of awesome. So, like, I feel like we should be taking priority over that. But also just the schools who have gardens, everyone that you meet on that campus after it's been kind of established for a while will tell you that they love it. The adults will tell you that they've had the best broccoli or whatever out of that garden. The students are happy. And you just, the culture of that school kind of changes a little, and it's just a little bit more happy.
Tell me what it... Talk about the success of having that school garden. Why are they giving you that kind of response? Have you been out there when they're in the garden, the children, and kind of the responses that the children have and the teachers?
I have, yeah. I have. I have seen some student and teacher interactions with the school garden, and it's fun. I've seen more like little kids in the garden than maybe the older kids. We have some FFA programs where they're kind of learning like plant science and animal science, which is interesting too, because a lot of those kids didn't grow up with agriculture and all of a sudden they are tied to it and they've learned so much from it and they kind of respect food in a different way that they hadn't before. And I think the same thing is true with little kids, but little kids are so curious about their surroundings, and I think sometimes as adults we kind of lose that curiosity just because of maybe overstimulation or we're too focused on whatever we have to get done. But little kids love gardening, even if you're just planting and they can't see anything right away. Like, you'd think a student would be like impatient, being like, we put a seed in the ground, and they're just like, I have to wait like 30 to 90 days to see something happening. But every little stage in that plant cycle is like something new and fun, and all the bugs and everything that happens throughout a plant's life cycle, I think, is just fascinating for kids. And what a lot of teachers or garden coordinators will say is that students with school gardens not only appreciate their garden, but they learn to appreciate their school campus and one another and other things in the environment, because everyone has almost like a common interest. You know, everyone wants this thing to grow well, and I've heard too that communities will kind of be on the watch for vandalism and things that might happen when school's not in session. And like, so it's kind of, it's weird. Plants are just happy and people get really happy about it. I used to have like a little desk garden, which my coworkers keep bugging me about to start one. But I work 4/10s, and so I'm only there 4 days of the week. And I'm like, well, these things still need to get watered when I'm not here. I should probably do some hydroponic stuff because I don't have to worry about it. But the office is happier when you have like little plants growing. And people who maybe weren't even interested in food before are like, what do you got growing here? And you're like, oh, just, you know, tomatoes. No big deal. I don't know. It's just, you're just happier with plants. I don't have like a scientific reason, but that's what I tend to see.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about can you tell me what food sustainability means to you?
Yes, and I thought about this. I think a lot of people would say that food sustainability is about sustaining food access for everyone throughout an entire food system. But I think it's a little deeper than that. I think that, yes, that's important. We want to make sure that everyone has access to fresh, healthy food that's good for their bodies and that they're going to eat. But I also think that in a healthy or sustainable food system, people value that food differently. And in a nutshell, they value people differently because it's people who create that food for you. And so I think that's what a sustainable food system means. But that's just me because I'm like a people person. And I think that when you value people, you can then value what they do, which is provide food and fiber and fuel for you. And to me, that's ideal.
why is that important?
Well, I mean, we are a population with dwindling numbers of people who work in agriculture. And without that, we can't survive. And something that I think is disappointing or something that concerns me, I actually worry about it sometimes, and I try not to because I don't know how to get out of that spiral sometimes. But when we relinquish control over our food and our fiber and our fuel, these things that we need to live and that are necessary for human beings to live, then just that, we lose control over it. We then no longer get a say in what happens to that, and essentially then what happens to us. And so I think it's disappointing that we have less numbers of people who are involved in agriculture, and in a sense we're giving up that control to maybe other countries or maybe, and I understand too that there's a need for even international export, right? We have places that grow coffee and bananas and stuff like that. We can't grow that here, so we have to barter and exchange to some extent. But I think when we give up farmland, really good farmland and things like that, and we have things like droughts and natural disasters that are happening, that's out of our control. But I think that when we give up that land, we're giving up that control. And that's so sad to me. Actually, I live out in Gilbert. I don't know if you've been, but we have quite a few farms out there that have been there probably forever. And a lot of our neighborhoods that are in developments used to be farms or ranches, and they're named after that farm or ranch. And so to me, it's so sad. Like, it's fun. I get to live there and still see agriculture like daily. Like, there'll be a tractor going down the road and you're just like patient because it can only go so fast. And you're like, I want to go 45, but this thing can go like 20. It's humbling, to get to live there. But at the same time, like, I'm living in a development that used to be a farm. And while my garden is probably better for it because it used to be farmland, so the soil is really great. Hopefully I don't mess that up. But it also makes me really sad. When I first moved out there, there was a little dairy, tiny dairy, compared to some of the larger dairies that we have, that probably went out of business somewhere in the year up there. So all of a sudden it was gone, paved over, and now they're you know, putting stuff on it. And to me, I'm just kind of like, do we really need another tire store? Like, couldn't this farm have just stayed here? Like, I was fine with it. I don't think I have to go like a mile down the road, there's another tire store. If I need a tire, I can just go to that one. But that's just not how the world works. If you can, in a developing area, you want to get in there quickly because then you'll become like, you know, a mainstay or whatever. And so anyway, it makes me sad that farmland gets developed, but at the same time, our population is growing, and like, what do you do with that? And that's a completely another area almost, but yeah, that makes me sad.
So let's talk a little bit about what factors do you think influence you to become involved in food sustainability?
What factors? Well, so this kind of goes back to why I got involved in the first place. When I was taking my healthcare innovations class, they mentioned that that obesity was an epidemic and that we were a very unhealthy population. Our American diet wasn't really serving us, and that most people die earlier in life because of our habits, our lifestyle habits. And so whether that's inactivity or eating poorly, we weren't taking care of ourselves, and that we could prevent so much money being kind of, wasted in healthcare on ourselves because we're abusing our bodies in a way. We're not taking care of them. We're not being good stewards of our body. And I don't know, I guess I felt that that's something that I could do. That's something that, because it was interesting to me and I cared enough to learn about chemistry and metabolism and how to cook things. And so that's really what influenced me to get involved, probably was the healthcare system and the fact that we're a nation of unhealthy people. And I actually saw this in my family too. I mentioned I was a baker. I would bake cookies. One of the things that we make at home a lot are these things called ginger snaps. And like, ginger snaps are not the crunchy ones. They were like soft and chewy and delicious. And we use Crisco, which is the only thing today that I still use Crisco in, because it just, butter just doesn't work. But I was making those all the time because, you know, in some people think that food is love. But I felt like I was loving my family by making these cookies. But then I realized I was probably attributing to our excessive waistlines, or, you know, we were indulging too much in cookies or whatever. And so I felt like I wasn't helping, I was hurting. And so, switching nutrition makes me feel like I'm doing good for the world by inspiring other people, hopefully, to eat healthfully and also, like, help make it normal. I think that's something that, in general, is hard. Even if you are someone who's trying to take care of yourself, you might be in a culture of people, or whoever your people are, maybe not interested in doing that because they're younger and they don't have to, they're not on medicine or they're not sick yet or whatever. It's really hard to be healthy if you have friends and family that aren't. That's not their choice. That's not their health, their lifestyle habits. And so hopefully I'm encouraging people to be healthy and happy and invest in themselves and the food that they eat. But I think that's what motivates me to stay here for sure.
Tell me about, let's talk a little bit about food justice and what do you think is important to the future of food justice? That may not be on your questions.
It is.
Okay, good.
I think food justice, comes back to valuing people, giving people workable wages, especially people who are working hard, doing manual labor, things you would never want to do. You should pay those people, right? so I think food justice comes back to that, just valuing people and valuing food, but more importantly, valuing people for what they provide for you. I don't know that there necessarily should be much of a difference of someone who's an athlete who provides you entertainment versus, arguably, there probably should be a difference. But I don't think our world's ever going to go that way. Or even someone who's an engineer who develops technology that makes your life easier. But what about these basic needs that you have, which is food, fiber, and fuel? What about those people who work in the sun? It is hot here. And they're working in those summer months too, or even when it's cold outside, like they're working hard, doing things you would never want to do, like I said. So to me, food justice means valuing those people.
Okay, so I have one more question to go back a little bit about that first internship you said at the Phoenix Market?
Yes.
Can you tell me what that internship, not the internship, but talk about the program itself that you were part of that was at the Phoenix Market?
Oh, so it wasn't really a program, I don't think.
Okay.
But when I was there anyway, maybe it turned into more of a program, but it was, we had a list of pre-approved sites from our community nutrition class that we could go and spend 12 hours at. And there was like contact information, you set it up as a student, and you just experienced whatever it is that that community place offered. And so I believe Cindy was my contact. And so I contacted her, let her know what I was who I was, and that I was interested in helping, volunteering, what can I do? Very helpful, please let me volunteer with you, kind of a thing. And so she took me on. I ended up staying. So the program was really with the school and kind of an informal contract, if you will, with these different community sites. It was kind of like if a student was interested in working at that site, they would contact you. They would fulfill their 12 hours. Someone like Cindy would sign off on those 12 hours, and then you would never see the student again. I just really liked the market and wanted to help Cindy, so I stayed there.
So let's talk about the market and what that was.
Yep.
Tell me what that was.
So in Arizona, we have a few farmers markets. We keep getting more. But farmers markets are places where... So Cindy was our market manager at Phoenix Public Market. She worked with a nonprofit called Community Connections. And her role there was to bring vendors. So vendors would pay a certain amount of money to be able to vend there weekly. We had a Wednesday and a Saturday market. You also could pay for tents and tables and chairs, or you could provide your own, which I think most vendors brought their own, especially if they were marketing a lot. We had produce vendors. Cindy worked really hard to make sure there was enough food there to keep people coming. So we had anything from ready-to-eat foods, like hot and ready-to-eat foods, to like we had coffee vendors who would come and set up like a little coffee bistro thing there, because who doesn't want coffee first thing while they're running the market? We had crafts. We had people who made soap, people who made things like bread, jewelry, art. She would also have like a local musician come in, and we had food trucks. So it was just kind of like this fun environment around food where you could do your grocery shopping, or you could just come and have breakfast, or you come and buy a gift or something like that. And I think Cindy was really good at what she does.
So you said you were able to use the SNAP card?
Yes.
So tell me about that and how you would entice people on a lower income to come to the market to purchase.
That's a good point. We used to have someone who would train certain producers for WIC and Farmers Market Nutrition Program vouchers. So those are certain funds that then allow people with EBT cards or those vouchers to then spend money on fresh produce at markets. We don't yet. I think some farmers might have offered a discount to those vendors if they had like a voucher. But it really just allowed you to spend your money at a farmer's market. It didn't necessarily give you a discount as someone of lower income buying at a farmer's market. And if you've ever shopped at a farmer's market, you know that the prices aren't always cheap. And so something that we haven't been successful in Arizona is something called like double up food bucks, which then provides an additional kind of some sort of assistance to provide a lower rate for things like fresh fruits and vegetables to participants of some sort of assistance program. What is that called? I can't remember the word.
That's okay. Would people still come to the farmers market and use?
It's mostly for people who are not of low income status. For some people who do shop there, I think it's more of the convenience that it's their neighborhood right there. But because those items are expensive, you don't see too many people shopping there with their EBT cards. We did see some, but not always, which is something in general the community of food justice people or the local food people are really concerned about, and something that we're hoping we can make a difference in. But it's certainly not enough because we don't have some sort of program to help make that cheaper for those people. It's difficult to incentivize them to come to the market for obvious reasons. I think probably the reason that someone would go to a farmer's market or choose to go to a farmer's market is maybe a relationship with a producer who might give you a discount, especially if it's like maybe not like the top item. Like I said, like the ugly carrot, like you'll sell me your ugly carrot for less or what have you, you can kind of barter and negotiate if you have a relationship in that way, which is kind of a neat thing about a farmer's market. But mostly just that I don't have to find a car or take a bus, and that adds time and money onto my shopping trip outside of having to actually go and spend time at a grocery store. So it's probably the people who live right there downtown that you would see coming to spend their EBT money.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about what you would like the food system in Phoenix to look like in 2040?
That's such a grandiose question. So I think, and just kind of generically, I think that it would be nice to see more people valuing the food producers in the area by supporting them and investing in them, but also valuing healthy foods over less healthy foods, or valuing healthy components of a community over less healthy components of a community. We talk about deserts in some areas. It would be nice to see grocery stores or farmers markets or farm stands or what have you in areas of low access to fresh fruits and vegetables and things like that. But in general, I think it would be nice to see a food system that respects values and utilizes and invests in its people, and that includes the people who produce food.
Why is that so important? And what don't people get about that?
I think people, and I am this way at times too, motivated by price. I mean, you're used to living a certain way, or you would like to live a certain way because that is successful or comfortable or what have you. And so that means you cut corners in some areas to make room for more luxurious accommodations. And so when you value food as just that food, you don't necessarily need to feel connected in one way or another. Like, all you care is that you're satisfying your hunger or possibly your desire to eat something delicious, that you don't have to prepare, or something convenient or whatever. You tend to look for what the best price is going to be instead of what your best value is going to be. And so I think that's something that people don't get is, I don't think people understand from a nutrition perspective that people understand that what you choose to fuel your body with, is going to impact your health down the road, if not directly. Some people struggle with disorders to where they see that impact regularly, whether they have celiac disease or diabetes or whatever, and they can see their decisions relatively quickly depending on how they're managing that disease. Whereas healthier people who maybe don't have an illness, or they don't go to the doctor, so they don't maybe know what their illness might be. Same could be with high blood pressure and all of that. You don't see the direct impact instantaneously. I think we're a society of instant gratification. I want change to happen right now. I'm guilty of that too. And so when you're not being a good steward of your body, or maybe even of your community, you don't see the impacts or of the choices that you make until sometimes it's too late. Well, you're in the hospital, have to take medicine, or so-and-so that you really liked going to or buying from, like, is now out of business. And you see that a lot with small businesses, is that they don't necessarily make it because so-and-so had it cheaper and they're a larger chain store possibly and not a smaller whatever business. And so kind of supporting, again, and investing in your neighbors and making sure that they can stay afloat is, I think, important. But that comes from, like, a people perspective and needing people in your life and needing that connection. But I think we tend in general to think almost selfishly, I need to take care of me, you know, and my choices are only going to impact me. But the reality is that your choices have a long-term effect on everyone.
So do you have any final closing thoughts, anything I didn't cover that you would like to discuss?
You have a question about policy, which I wasn't necessarily going to say anything about, but I actually went to ASU Sustainability because I'm a nerd. People are like, what are you doing tonight? You're like, I'm skipping the gym because I'm going to go to a lecture.
they had a documentary called Just Eat It. So it was about food waste and more call to action on the consumer level to eat what you buy and kind of value what you buy. And don't buy something you're not going to eat, or don't take more than you're going to eat and waste it, because the impacts are beyond you. And so because of my role at department, there's not a whole lot I can do in terms of policy advocacy or policy change. I kind of just steer clear from it. I know what rules, and I'm just like, I just don't, in a lot of ways, I think policy is just something that's written on a piece of paper and it's not necessarily enforced. And so in some ways I'm like, God, we work so hard on policy, but like at the end of the day, people do whatever they want anyway. But after that documentary, I realized we got into a conversation about City of Tempe was talking about maybe developing a compost program in addition to recycling and trash. And that's something that San Francisco does. And I've always thought that was kind of neat. Like, I would be way more inclined to compost if someone would take care of the compost part for me, because I don't want smelly stuff in my backyard. And what if I do it wrong? Like, I have to have the right combination of, like, carbon and phosphorus. And, like, what if I don't do it right? And I think it's probably not that complicated. But it's certainly uncomfortable if you're unfamiliar with it. And so in some ways, I'm like, that's a good idea, incentivizing changing a policy within a city government to say we're gonna add composting to something that we do on top of trash and recycle, and some other policies that I think sometimes it's policy can be smart to where it incentivizes someone to change, as opposed to and making it like something you can choose to do but not maybe required to do, because I think when you require something that not everyone agreed on, there's a lot of backlash and. Who needs more drama? but the same thing with businesses too, kind of incentivizing businesses to change too, or we talk about local wellness policies at schools, incentivizing change to happen by making it more something that's allowable or normal as opposed to required. So that's all I was going to say about that.
Okay. Anything else that you'd like to cover?
Nope.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It was great. This is a continuation of our interview on August 28th. You were telling me about the gardens on Central?
Yes. Yeah, so some of our smaller producers are actually really interesting, their stories. One in particular is our International Rescue Committee. They've kind of banded all of their international farmers together and call themselves the Gila, sorry, blanking now, Gila Cooperative or Gila Co-op or something like that. But they're our IRC producers, and they come from different countries of various backgrounds, and they grow really unique products that grow really well in our climate here, which is fascinating and awesome to see. And I really encourage them, or this cooperative, to sell to our schools in the capacity of our fresh produce, our fresh fruit and vegetable grant program, because that's a taste experience program. There's a little bit extra money to spend on specialized items. And what better way to teach kids about fruits and vegetables, but things that they would never see in the grocery store or at home, just because you can't access it at the grocery store or at home. Things like Persian cucumbers, which they're huge. It's about this big in diameter, I'd say. And if you were to, it kind of is kind of kinky, and it looks like a snake almost. And it has these huge ribbons of dark green and light green stripes. So they're growing like unique things like that. And those are the places too where you'll see things like amaranth being growing and native crops being grown outside of things that you could get at the grocery store. And so what's fascinating about that is not only that that's a great opportunity to buy local in schools, but also to support a community of producers who come from different countries and keep their business or their cooperative afloat, which is awesome. Okay.
Do you have any other programs that you want to share about that? Do you think are unique or creative?
No.
Okay, just want to make sure. So let's talk a little bit about the Healthy Harvest project.
So something that a lot of states do for farm-to-school development is to encourage food service to buy locally. They do that by providing procurement incentives in some way, or focal points
procurement focal points for schools by developing marketing materials and family newsletters that coincide with the growing season of a particular area. Sometimes you see that coming from like a state department like ourselves, or you see that coming from a nonprofit that kind of services the whole state or just a region of a state. It started in California, but the idea is that once a month you pick a fruit or vegetable to focus on. There's a lot of nutrition and agricultural facts that coincide with that item to help kind of bridge the gap of where your food comes from. It's great for food service because marketing materials are already developed. That's something that food service does not have to invest any resources in outside of possibly printing it. They put that in their cafeteria along with whatever they just choose to menu for that month. They highlight it as a special item. Kids get really pumped about it. They provide family newsletters that are part of this program back to parents, that parents know about it, and parents are really psyched about food service. And often in some cases, too, there are some classroom material components, something for the teacher to then correlate whatever is happening in the cafeteria or growing in that area back into the classroom and whatever concepts are being learned there. And so we did a pilot project earlier this year with Tempe School District, where we created, it was our way of our way at the department helping schools, or hopefully helping schools, create marketing materials that they don't have time to create, but also helping them to focus on our vegetable subgroups of the National School Lunch Program. So we chose to focus on vegetables, which is perfect because we grow a lot of vegetables here and not a whole lot of fruit. And we wanted to focus on three main subcategories of the National School Lunch Program: dark red, orange vegetables, dark green vegetables, and then legumes or bean and pea vegetables. The other two categories are other and starchy. So starchy are things like corn and potatoes, regular potatoes, because sweet potatoes are considered an orange vegetable. But then the other is where things like asparagus and red beets and like bok choy is a green. Like green beans end up. Like the other is kind of like the misfits that don't fit into the other categories. So anyway, because dark green, dark red, orange, and the bean and pea categories are a struggle point for food service to get kids to eat, we thought, let's try developing marketing materials and special menu items that will get kids excited about the specialness of these vegetables. And so we developed these marketing materials in partnership with Arizona Department of Health Services. They had a dietitian on staff, they had a Spanish translator on staff, and We ended up using both the Arizona Department of Education's graphic design artist, but then also the graphic design artist of Department of Health, just because there was a lot of work to go in building these materials, and everyone's busy, so we just kind of divided projects, and we got it done. So, I mean, it took like 6 months to develop those materials, which I way underestimated. I was like, so I'll just write these things up really quickly, and no, there's so many approvals and everything that we had to get through. But in the long run, it was they're beautiful items. I'm really happy that we were able to do it. It was something I've wanted to do for years, and we find out later this in September if we get to expand that program with some grant funds. But we have four categories. We picked five items. Only four of them are complete. There's the fifth item that we kind of, because with the National School Lunch Program subcategories, beans are considered a vegetable or a meat alternative. And in years prior, in lots of USDA marketing nutrition education, that beans were only considered a meat alternative for years. And so there was no, there was no like pre-existing material to look at on how to talk about beans as a vegetable, like pinto beans or garbanzo beans or something like that. And so the Department of Ed decided that we were going to do everything but the family newsletter for that. The family newsletter was our most content-heavy piece or item that we created out of this series. We created posters for the cafeteria. We created a family newsletter. And we created a banner. And each banner, that's probably 5 foot tall, let's say, was just a big item that could be moved around in the cafeteria, which is important for food service, that then just talked in general about each of those categories. So we had a dark green one, a bean and pea one, and a dark red orange one. And it really just gave why it's important to eat from this category, some pictures of some common ones that you might see. It had a calendar of Arizona's growing season of those particular color of vegetables, and just some it was just really nice to look at. Something that would really grab someone's attention if they were going through the lunch line. And then we had little posters for each particular item that we chose to focus on for the pilot. So we focused on winter squash in January, spinach in February, broccoli in March, and then carrots in April, and then beans in May. So for the whole spring semester, we focused on one item throughout the month. And we offered it once a week throughout Tempe School District at three different, well, we offered it menu-wide or district-wide. So they have about 20 sites. And then we went out and did some observational studies and coincide with production records from food service. So they mark on these production records what they produce, what's being served, and what's left over. And then we compared that against what we saw in the cafeteria, which was kind of intimidating to like go and watch kids eat food because, of course, they're curious and they totally know that you're there for that reason. After a while, they're like, you're going to watch me eat something. And we try to be discreet about it, but it did not work for a while. We try to be just like extra aides in the cafeteria. But after a while, the kids are pretty smart. They're like, what are you watching me eat today? And we're like, just your spinach salad. So anyway, we created that program, which is, it's not, I wouldn't say it's creative or innovative per se, because other states have done it too. But what's different about our program compared to other programs is that we chose to focus on vegetables that are directly from the National School Lunch Program. And that we only focused on vegetables and not also fruits. But, I mean, I think it would have looked similar if we hadn't really particularly thought about that because we're such a vegetable-heavy state.
Why was it important to connect the dots of doing the newsletter and the having the from the cooking to the children to the families to the administration? Why was connecting all those dots critical?
So connecting all those dots are super important. And they'd be important outside of farm to school, too, is just that those departments within a school are not always known for communicating well with one another. Often cafeteria is very siloed from classroom, and sometimes even administration is kind of siloed from the other two. So it's really important when you're doing something like farm to school, which is benefit to the entire school community, to let parents know that this is what's happening in the cafeteria. It brings a connection point from parents and teachers and students that the cafeteria is doing something really great and different, and this is why we're doing it, and this is what we're doing. It's important to have marketing materials in the cafeteria so that you remember that today's the day we're serving butternut squash. And it's really important for administration to be on board, too, because they obviously want to serve a really great program in all of their schools. And the better connected all of those departments are, the stronger that program is going to be. And I think just in general, the happier everyone's going to be because everyone's on the same page at that point. So
let's talk a little bit about the farm to preschool.
So farm to preschool is a relatively new era of farm to school, I'd say, for a long time. And this happens, I think, too, in general with like National School Lunch Program. We saw changes of the National School Lunch nutrition requirements change 10 years ago in 2010 with the Healthy Younger Free Kids Act, but we didn't see similar changes with our child and adult care program. So they kind of got like the second, like, oh, okay, this worked, so let's try, you know, working with our younger kids, which is so interesting because developmentally 0 to 5 is so important for kids' development. And so why are we not using things like gardens in their education or their learning? Sensory learning is super important for those kids. And so it's kind of a growing movement now to focus beyond K through 12 and working with that younger population to understand where their food's coming from. But more likely but maybe more importantly, to get them to invest in being more open-minded palate-wise with their vegetables and to try new things, because that's only going to invest in what kind of kids or palates we have adapted when they grow older and you know, enter elementary school. So we are beginning those works now to focus on those clients or those kiddos. And our Maricopa County Health Department is actually doing a focus group with homes and centers of who operate like a preschool type setting. And we're talking with owners and we're talking with staff about what is their interest or prior knowledge of farm to preschool and what is their interest in implementing and what barriers are what would make them hesitant to start and how can we help bridge that gap kind of. And so that's pretty exciting news for sure. I imagine that many of them will want to start gardens, which is fun because, like I had mentioned, kids get so excited about growing things. But what's also interesting is that adults get so excited to watch kids get excited about growing food. So, and everyone's learning together too. So, like, little kids are so much more adaptable, it seems, to a failure, you know? Oh, that failed. It's okay. You know, and because you're an adult trying to make it okay for a little kid, you're almost more okay with that failure. And like, it's just trial and error, but I think that everyone's happier with that failure than maybe in other instances.
Okay. Do you have anything else to share that just came to mind? that we didn't cover? Any of the programs, projects?
There's one thing that's not done yet. So I will, for that Healthy Harvest program, I will eventually have a report available that showcases what we've seen. So did we see increased consumption or did we not really see much of a difference? And I'm also going to finish. Right now, we have a school garden map, which is not innovative or anything, but other states have that too. A map of where all of our school gardens are in Arizona. And that's K-12. It doesn't include preschool, but it's just a Google map at this point. I have to justify spending money on something that's better, more expensive than free. But we have about 200 school gardens in Arizona from the information we've gathered. That's about 2,000 schools in Arizona, so we have about 10% of our schools have school gardens, active school gardens. We verified that earlier this year. And we have garden maps so you can see where it is. So on our website, azed.gov, you can look at our garden map right now. You can only look at gardens in Maricopa County, but Maricopa County and Pima County are our most populated counties, and that's where most of our gardens are located, but we do have some in our more rural or other counties, so that's exciting.
It is. Anything else?
No.
Okay. Thank you.